Science fiction writer Samuel Delaney immediately explodes any preconceptions we might form of him. He grew up in Harlem's middle class, the son of a mortician. He attended the Bronx High School of Science for gifted students, despite his severe dyslexia. And though he married poet Marilyn Hacker while he was still in his teens, he's a very outspoken gay man. He worked as a folk singer, too, once with a bigger billing than newcomer Bob Dylan. Delaney has written close to 20 science fiction books, including Babel 17, Dahlgren, and the Navarian series. He's also written analyses of the language used in science fiction, and he's credited with introducing many stylistic innovations into the form. Delaney's work explores the cultural, sexual, linguistic, and aesthetic biases that control our lives. Samuel Delaney has just written a memoir entitled The Motion of Light in Water, Sex and Science Fiction Writing in the East Village, 1957 to 1965. When he first sat down to write science fiction, he took it on almost as a challenge.
I'd been having discussions with Marilyn, who at that point was working as an assistant editor at Ace Books, that published a great deal of science fiction, and we'd been having all these discussions about the science fiction novels that she was editing, and she had a great many criticisms of them, and one of the impetuses behind the book was to write a book that would take care of some of these things, and so in that sense the book was kind of written before her. It also grew out of a whole set of rather troubling dreams that I was having at the time. It was shortly after we were married. I wanted the book to be science fiction. I'm not one of the people who there are some writers who say take down all the barriers and make it a real adventure for the reader walking into the bookstore. But I think that's kind of counterproductive.
How much of your writing is generated by dreams?
Not terribly much. A scene here or a single idea there. I can point to maybe four or five places in an oeuvre that now contains about 16 or 17 novels or novel-length works of fiction, and maybe four or five scenes, out of all of that. Not usually whole books.
You were occasionally rubbing shoulders with literary lions of the time and in the village. You tell a very amusing story of having W.H. Auden over for a dinner of shrimp curry with red wine in
yes.
a sweltering apartment.
and another ghastly juxtapositions, yes.
Well, not bad. I mean, you were, what, 18, playing
right,
host with
Marilyn? Yeah.
Did the topic of science fiction come up that evening?
At one point it did. Marilyn had given some poems to Auden, and basically the evening was very much hers, because they had discussed her poetry, and poetry was the topic of the night. At one point, very politely, Auden turned to me and said, "And what do you do?" And so I answered back, "Well, I scribble science fiction to survive." And that was when I was in the middle of writing the what eventually became my first science fiction novel. The only thing at the time, one, nobody had bought the book, nobody had even read it, nor was it finished. So the notion of surviving through doing this was really something of a bit of wish fulfillment on my part. I also, sort of as soon as I heard myself say it, and indeed Auden then turned to Chester Kallman, who was with us that evening, and said, he scribbles science fiction to survive. And when I heard the words come back to me, they sounded just awful. I sort of turned red to the cheeks and sat there feeling really strange for the rest of the evening. There was some relief in it a couple of years later when I discovered in The Age of Anxiety, Auden's book-length poem. He says that, human beings are creatures who cannot be anything without pretending to be at first, but that, I think, was the moment in which I was pretending to be a science fiction writer and learned that maybe my notion of the pretense was not the best way to do it.
My guest here on Fresh Air today is science fiction writer Samuel Delaney. Your book is subtitled Sex and Science Fiction Writing in the East Village,
yes,
1957 to 1965. What for you was important about writing about these two subjects in your memoirs?
Well, I think during that time, perhaps the dates more accurately should have been 1960 to 1965, but nevertheless, I think during those years there were large changes changes of attitude both towards art in general and towards sex in particular. You hear a lot of talk of sexual revolution, the whole sort of underpinnings of art that that eventually necessitated a term like postmodernism. At this point, these were becoming material forces that were actually changing the way people thought about art, their bodies, and their lives. And so these are kinds of some of the topics of this particular book, the occasion for which is a kind of autobiographical memoir.
You write throughout the book about being, I guess, very much a marginal person at the time. You were black, you were gay, you were extremely bright, you'd gone to Bronx Science School, and what that means you had an IQ of over 140.
And well, that was the average IQ.
There were people who
had IQs substantially less, and people with IQs substantially more.
And you were a writer, so clearly you transcended a lot of borders, and you also weren't easily fit into any of the so-called normal categories. Did you seem to view this, your place in the world, with a great deal of humor?
Well, I think it's an education. What happens, I think, if you are in any of those categories is, or if you're in more than one of those categories, certainly what happens is you begin to, you get the ordinary view of the world, but you also get a marginal view as well. People tend to assume, I think, somehow that anyone in any one of those categories only has the marginal view. Well, what you have to develop what the writer, the black writer, Du Bois called a kind of double vision, which allows you to see things more or less from the view of the center, even if you don't inhabit that place yourself, because if you don't understand it fairly well, you literally don't survive. On the other hand, you have a kind of critical stance from which to view that, quote, center, unquote, and critique it from. And so you do get this kind of double vision of things. If you happen to belong to all three categories, black, gay, and an artist as well, then you have three margins from which to critique the center, and the center stops looking so central at that point.
Well, it seems that science fiction is an ideal outlet to write about this, because science fiction in many ways is about transcending boundaries of all kinds, stepping into other times, imagining universes where there are hermaphrodite characters and other forms of sexuality. Is this part of what appealed to you about writing science fiction?
Well, at the time I started, there wasn't a great deal of that. The notion that a genre, just because it's on the edge itself and is a marginal genre itself, has a innate sympathy to things marginal is not necessarily the case. In fact, I think what you're more likely to get at the beginning of marginal genres is a kind of insecurity, the insecurity that frequently breeds at the margin and an attempt to cling even closer to an imagined center. A good deal of science fiction, certainly the most popular science fiction, especially at that time, tended to be distressingly right-wing in its general view of things.
Was this in part because of a fascination with technology and technocracy?
I don't think it was technology per se. I think it was just that there was a... on the one hand, well, let me see if we can sort of historify it a little bit. Many of the writers back in the 30s and 40s certainly had strong leftist sympathies. Among the people who were involved in that group, there were a number of writers who found it, although socially they gravitated to this particular group, intellectually they found their greatest pleasure in épataying les gauchistes, in sort of slapping the wrists of their leftist friends, and frequently they became the most popular science fiction writers to break out of this. I'm thinking particularly of writers like Heinlein, Poole Anderson, perhaps to a somewhat lesser extent Gordon Dixon, and writers such as that. It is no accident that the crossover writers, you know, were people like Heinlein, who were gentlemen writers socially. They were gentlemen writers in the midst of a largely left social group. But once the works did cross over, what you got basically was the conservative argument. So that was the situation in which science fiction more or less found itself at the end of the 50s, and it was only sort of with the advent of some writers towards the beginning of the 60s, Dish, Joanna Russ, Roger Zelazny, myself, Ursula Le Guin, and various and sundry others, that you began to get a... I wouldn't call any of those writers other than myself specifically leftist per se. They're certainly more liberal than not. Mm-hmm. But you get a kind of ideological sophistication in the writing that is lacking in a lot of the writing before.
What's compelled you to write an autobiography? You're, what, 46, 47?
46. Mm-hmm. I don't really know. I suppose part of it is coming from that, coming from the Stonewall generation, and Stonewall was, of course, the place at the gay bar in New York in 1968, in which when the police raided it, the client stood up to the police, and there was a quite a fracas, and it was kind of the beginning of gay liberation, or at least it's frequently cited as the beginning of the most modern leg of gay liberation. And one of the things that politically came out of that is that it is very, very necessary for people to for gay people to talk about themselves, to make it clear who they were, where they were. One of the greatest threats that we had to face, that the gay community had to face up until that time, was the threat of blackmail. And it was a strange and insidious double bind. On the one hand, you have a society that says it's bad to be gay. Therefore, we will blackmail you you can't have jobs because you're a security risk. Because you're too easy to blackmail, and you know it goes around, but at the same time, you know, it's still the heterosexual world is doing the blackmailing, if you will. So it goes around and around a circle, and the only way to break out of that is to do what eventually came to be known as coming out of the closet. So I suppose since I belong to that political generation, part of the impetus for writing the book is to talk about what the reality of a certain kind of life is and was.
And a lot of the reality at that time was, I think for you, a great deal of confusion. You were married at the time to Marilyn Hacker,
yeah.
Poet.
Mm-hmm.
You were exploring the East Village homosexual life, and you were making your name as a writer. How did you keep what was going on in your mind straight?
Well, obviously I didn't. I think I get points for doing that.
Now, by didn't, what were the consequences?
Well, I think one of the things that I realized is that that with each of those marginal situations, like it or not, comes a certain kind of responsibility. The responsibility is unfortunately something that is lumbered on you by the rest of society, but the responsibility, to the extent that you want to be true to yourself, requires a certain honesty and a certain kind of bravery to stand up to the kinds of pressures that are put on you.
I have to tell you, when I go into bookstores, I'm often struck by the cover art of science fiction novels. Sometimes they're very lurid, sort of muscular scenes of men and women or of creatures in strange light. What's your reaction to cover art of science fiction novels?
Well, it's a kind of sign system in which basically the cover, at the best of times, tries to indicate to the reader what subgenre the book belongs to. Very frequently it misrepresents that subgenre, at which point we call it, bad advertising. It's interesting because the paperback field is going through a kind of change. Up until fairly recently, 6 or 7 years ago, paperback books were an item of what they used to call impulse buying. You went into the store or you passed by a bookstand, and if something caught your eye, you just bought it. But at this point, when paperback books are, the cheapest of them are $3.95, $4.50, $5.95, it's no longer an item of impulse buying, and the covers have not quite reflected this, because the covers, especially of the science fiction novels, are still being designed to appeal to the impulse buyer, when at this point most of the buyers of books are not impulse buyers anymore. If they're not looking for a particular book, they are going in looking for reading for a particular situation.
Well, what are some of the subgenres of science fiction? I mean, how would you make a tree of that? You've got overall science fiction. Then what comes out of that?
Well, you have hard science fiction, which tends to be science fiction with an emphasis on the science and the technology, and usually what they call a technophilic attitude. You get the impression that the characters or the writer of the book likes technology. Then you have more. You have softer sciences, where the emphasis is on sociology and psychology, or some other one of the what the Europeans call the human sciences. And then there are there's a whole range of sort of sub fantasy categories, everything from
sword and sorcery,
mm-hmm. Yeah, which is really a subgenre of all of its own. Invented by a strange young man named Robert E. Howard back in the 30s.
And where do your books fit in? Where would you put yours in that category? Are they more a political?
Well, they range over the whole field, I think. Some of them, a book like Nova, is pretty much it's an adventure and pretty much a hard science novel. A book like Dahlgren, which is a very long, very soft science fiction novel. And the books that I've been working on for mostly the last 10 years, a set of stories, short novels, and indeed a couple of full-length novels in the series set in this imaginary land called Neverian. These are very much sword and sorcery stories. They really have almost no science fiction content and are more a kind of idealized historical fantasy about the beginnings of civilization and how everything that we recognize today more or less got itself going.
My guest is science fiction writer Samuel Delaney. His books include Dahlgren, Nova, and the Neverian series. He's just written a memoir titled The Motion of Light in Water. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with science fiction writer Samuel Delaney. Do you deal with the issue of AIDS at all in your writing?
Well, yes. I have the dubious distinction of being the person who wrote the first novel-length treatment of AIDS to be published in the United States. The book was written in 1984 and published in 1985. It's part of the Neverian series. It's a novel called The Tale of Plagues and Carnivals that's contained in a book that has two short stories and a full-length novel in it called Flight from Neverian, the third volume in the Neverian series.
What did you know about AIDS at the time you wrote this book, and what was your imagination about this epidemic?
Well, at the time I wrote the book, which was basically early part of 84, before the HTLV or HAV virus was discovered, what I was mostly interested in was the way we had a disease that at that point had afflicted only, only 4,000 or 5,000 people at the time. At that time, it seemed like a tremendous amount. One was not aware of a new disease coming along and a fatal disease slaying that many people. But one of the things that was most interesting about it to me was the fact that there was no medical reason for it. We hadn't discovered a germ, so it was catapulting everybody back into an almost medieval situation where you had a disease that, for all practical purposes, was at the time was thought to be completely fatal, and still largely is. Ordinary critical restraints of science were not coming into play, and it was that itself made it a terribly imaginatively volatile disease, and one that kept on sort of reaching out for strange and bizarre metaphors. It made it very easy to manipulate for all sorts of non reasons that didn't have to do either with science, didn't have to do with medicine. It was connected with blood. It was connected with perverted sex. It made it mythologically terribly volatile. And while you had voices like Susan Sontag saying that the healthy way to have a disease is not to use it for metaphors, AIDS became sort of metaphorical every time you turned around. And I was trying to explore some of the ways this was sedimenting. The actual discovery of the virus is an incident in the novel, and simply recorded off the news program, I think it was on April 24th, 1984, when it happened. And so most of the book takes place before the discovery of the virus, although it laps into the point where it becomes medicalized. Mm-hmm. But this is what the basic topic of the thing was. It's a book that takes place both in an imaginary land that is afflicted by an AIDS-like disease, and in the streets of New York, and in the subway johns of New York, and with real people, providing correspondences between the sort of imaginary world where it keeps on becoming a metaphor.
And since that time, how has AIDS affected what it is you write about?
Since that time, it's certainly become it's become one of the strands of the real world that is reflected here and there in everything. It hasn't been the central topic of a work since then, but it's certainly something that lends its, that shines its light on pretty much everything.
Well, science fiction is often used to illuminate our own time, even though it may be set in another world, in another culture. Are you able to sort of escape dealing with AIDS in this way then? You
can, No, I don't think. Science fiction as a way to escape dealing with anything is not the best science fiction. Basically, science fiction gives you a vantage to look at and analyze what's of real concern to you in your real life. Science fiction is not about the future. Science fiction is gives you a tool where you can set up a significant dialogue with the here and now. The distortions of science fiction only uses the future as a literary convention or as a writing convention to set up some kind of dialogue with what's really going on now. So the escapist value of science fiction is, I think, only secondary to what makes it really, really of interest to us.
You've written that language can be isolating. Language sets people apart from one another in forms of categories. You write about the specific vocabulary of homosexual behavior in the East Village, and you say that you may wonder why you're writing so explicitly about some of your sexual adventures as a young man, particularly in this time of AIDS. Could you elaborate on why you do that?
Well, not too long ago, there was an interview with gay writer Harvey Fierstein in Playboy, and he made the very good point in his interview that the 60s was not the sexual revolution. What we're going through now is the sexual revolution, and AIDS indeed is a part of that. It's not necessarily the pleasantest part, but it's certainly the thing that makes the necessity for changing sexual behavior and really critiquing it in some very, very strong and realistic ways, very, very important. In terms of my book, I think it's necessary for people to know what real live people have done in order to provide pleasure for themselves. And many of these things are the kinds of things that in terms of the bourgeois heterosexual centrality seem a little strange, I think, at first. Although the various things that go on there are, if one examines them closely, can look pretty strange too. Nevertheless, so this is one of the things that the book is trying to do. Not so much as nostalgia, but just as analysis of some of the things that actually went on.
My guest on Fresh Air today is science fiction writer Samuel Delaney. As a young man, you had difficulty reading. You were diagnosed as being dyslexic.
Severely.
How did this come into your life for your wordplay? A lot of your writing is filled with wordplay and use of language in unorthodox ways on the page. Is this a direct reflection of your dyslexic experience?
I don't really know. Various and sundry critics have theorized on that, and most of the theorizing has felt somewhat off to me. There is the fact that a number of writers have been dyslexic, and some of the particular ones that are most well known is the French novelist Flaubert, who was known as the idiot of the family because it took him so long to learn how to read, and that's the name of the big three-volume biography that Jean-Paul Sartre wrote of Flaubert just before he died, and also William Butler Yeats, who didn't really learn how to read until he was 16. His father used to read to him endlessly, and it was only, you know, when he was in his middle teenage period that he really became comfortable reading. It's very possible that Virginia Woolf was also dyslexic. There's a good chance that Keats was. F. Scott Fitzgerald is another name that from their first drafts, there's a lot of evidence that dyslexia was present. It's intriguing that many of the writers who were dyslexics are the ones that we think of, particularly as stylists, in the range of writers. And it's possible that dyslexia makes language something that you have to manipulate conscientiously rather than just let it flow. Now, on the other hand, a writer like James Joyce was as lexic as they come, and I think he wrote something like a third of Ulysses and Galleys, which means basically in about 2.5 months. Even in France in the 1920s, you didn't have galleys for all that long.
You were punished as a student for your terrible misspellings by being forced to go to the dictionary and look up your words. At least once.
Yeah.
I'm amazed that you were able to keep a connection with words after that experience that I would think would drive some people far away from the dictionary.
Well, again, paradoxically, frequently dyslexics are highly verbal people. Not necessarily, though. I have a number of friends, for instance, who are dyslexics who just weren't blessed with the good fortune to start off with a high IQ. Dyslexia has nothing to do with basic intelligence, and this is one of the things it's kind of hard to make clear to people. A dyslexic may be very, very bright. A dyslexic may be perfectly normal in intelligence, or a dyslexic may be subnormal. It affects something like 1 out of 10 males. Like colorblindness, it's sexual. It's hereditary and sexually linked. But as I said, I have some friends who are dyslexic who with perfectly normal intelligence whom it hurt a great deal more than it did me, simply because I had available a certain number of strategies to get around it. And that's basically what one has to do. There isn't really an overcoming it. You just develop ways to compensate.
Well, Samuel Delaney, thank you very much for coming in.
Okay, thank you very much, Setch.
Samuel Delaney's new memoir is titled The Motion of Light on Water, Sex and Science Fiction Writing in the East Village. It's published by Arbor House. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.